Today, a full jury was impaneled in Donald Trump's New York hush money case. A full jury. To be specific, 12 jurors and one alternate have now been picked. But before the trial can get underway, the court still has to pick five more alternate jurors. With the pace this is going, though, that could very easily happen tomorrow, putting this trial on track for opening statements to start Monday. Or some of those seated jurors could drop out tomorrow, which is not an entirely unprecedented scenario, because before the jury grew today, it shrank. Today started with two already seated jurors being excused, being removed from the jury. The first to be excused was juror number two. And to understand why, you first have to understand what has been happening in conservative media.
I believe that no matter what they do here, this is a hate Donald Trump jury.
I saw one that listens to The Breakfast Club with Charmaine the God. The other works at Disney. Right? That could be dicey. And the other one reads the Daily News. The Daily News is the most anti-Trump newspaper in the country.
Juror number two. She said two things that really stuck out. One, quote, I don't really have an opinion of Trump. And, quote, no one is above the law. I'm not so sure about juror number two.
Yeah, pretty skeptical about people who believe that no one is above the law. Yesterday, that person, juror number two, called the court to make clear that she was worried about continuing to serve on this jury. Today, the judge called her back into court to explain what was worrying her. And here's what she said. I definitely have concerns now, one of them especially being that aspects of my identity have already been out there in public. Yesterday alone, I had friends, colleagues, and family push things to my phone regarding questioning my identity as a juror. She went on to explain that because of that experience, because she was bombarded with press and because of just how many people could tell who she was from publicly reported details, even though the jury is supposed to be anonymous, because of all of that, she no longer felt she could be impartial. She couldn't ignore what she described as outside influences that might affect her decision making in the courtroom. Now, there are a lot of issues at play here. One is that through this jury selection process, we have learned a lot of identifying details about this jury. And the press, by and large, has published those details, which, of course, threatens the jury's anonymity. But the other issue at play here that I do not think we can ignore is that conservatives and right-wing media are actively trying to demonize members of this jury. Some are doing it in broad strokes, claiming that any New York jury must be biased by virtue of the fact that they're in New York. And others are going further, claiming that liberals are trying to sneak onto this jury, claiming that the jury selection process itself is rigged.
Trump's lawyers already catching a handful of lib activists trying to sneak onto the jury. Having a Democrat prosecutor and a Democrat donor judge in a Democrat city isn't enough. They need to rig the jury, too.
Now, the Fox fearmongering here has not been limited to Fox airwaves. Last night, Trump posted this to Truth Social, questioning, quoting Jesse Waters. They are catching undercover liberal activists lying to the judge in order to get on the Trump jury. Trump himself is calling the jury pool biased against him. He is accusing the jury selection of being rigged. Now, there's a lot to unpack there, like how that post was one of seven posts the district attorney's office flagged to the judge today as potential violations of Trump's gag order. And we're going to get into that in a little more detail later this hour. But let's begin with the fact that the narrative Jesse Waters and Donald Trump are pushing here is literally the exact opposite of what we are actually seeing in the court. Last night, while Trump was posting Jesse Waters' conspiracies to Truth Social, Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg's team was emailing Trump's lawyers and the judge. As one of Bragg's prosecutors explained in court today, they discovered that one of the previously seated jurors, or at least someone with the same name, had been arrested in the 1990s in Westchester for tearing down political advertisements. Specifically, political posters that were on the right, the political right. So that's a juror potentially tearing down right-wing propaganda. Now, the juror in question, who was previously juror number four, he had not disclosed this information in his jury questionnaire. But Alvin Bragg's team said they believe that they were legally and ethically obligated to bring this information to the court's attention, and so they did. Just to be completely above board here, no reporters were able to hear the conversation with the judge, so we don't actually know if prosecutors' concerns panned out. But ultimately, juror number four was excused from this jury, a juror who may have had a strong anti-conservative bent, a juror who may have even been anti-Trump, flagged by the prosecution. That is how fair this jury selection process is in reality. Alvin Bragg's team is doing everything it can to make sure there isn't a hint of anything that could be perceived as bias on the jury, because the prosecution very much wants this to be a fair trial. But Trump and conservative media are already setting the stage to blame the jury if Trump is found guilty. Just like they do with elections, the narrative here cannot be, it cannot be, that Donald Trump lost because of who he is or what he's done. The narrative has to be that the whole thing was rigged. And that brings us to the most pressing part of all of this, the safety of the jurors. By painting the jury as rigged, Trump and the conservative media are putting a target on the backs of these normal people, literally people just showing up for jury duty. At this point, that is part of a very clear pattern. Donald Trump demonized election workers, and then his supporters threatened and attacked them. Donald Trump demonized court staff and prosecutors and judges, and then his supporters threatened and harassed them. Donald Trump demonized the FBI, and now multiple Trump supporters have physically attacked FBI field offices. Multiple FBI offices. Today, the judge in this case asked the press to limit the amount of identifying information we as the press publish about these jurors. Understanding the physical danger that information could put them in, one would hope most of the members of the press will comply. I know we will. But what happens if other people aren't as cautious? What happens if Donald Trump or even just conservative media keep demonizing these people, saying they are secret partisans out to destroy Donald Trump? What happens if they put the jury in danger?
CNN says, don't talk about the stealth libs trying to sneak onto the case. You're putting their lives in danger.
I'm a little surprised that we are learning all of this, because I do not think this jury is going to remain anonymous necessarily if they keep this up.
You're worried about their safety?
Yeah, I'm worried about their safety. I mean, it's up to them if they want to write a book after all this is said and done, but that's their option. They shouldn't be out of this way. They're not supposed to be out of this way.
So the seven jurors who are already chosen, can we trust them?
That was last night, right before Jesse Waters brought on, I kid you not, a body language expert to give her take on which jurors would be good or bad for Donald Trump. Waters was back at it again, describing each new individual juror. This is this evening, saying a few details about the juror and then using that information to imply certain jurors are anti-Trump. That is what is happening right now. Joining me now are Jeremy Saland, a former assistant district attorney in the Manhattan DA's office trial division, and Ankush Kardori, a former federal prosecutor who is now a senior writer for Politico magazine. Jeremy, let me just first start with you about what is happening here in the larger picture of how the court's being discussed, the judge, the prosecutors, and now the jury. What are the implications for the American justice system?
You have to first separate the Donald Trump who's on trial, who is innocent until proven guilty. He's as responsible as you and I are, which is nothing until that burden and if that burden is met. Separate that from the Donald Trump who is vitriolic, who says reprehensible things, who's dangerously reckless, and is personally responsible for undermining the criminal justice system. And I say that boldly because it's accurate. And these other folks, some in the media, some who just follow him, it's almost as if they're imbibing on some Jonestownian Kool-Aid, and they're just going after it and going after it and perpetuating it. And my big fear, and everyone's fear should be, that it's something that could be indelible, at least for this generation. And that's very concerning. Innocent until proven guilty, and if proven guilty. But outside of that courtroom, it's really ugly.
Well, to that point, the Jonestown Kool-Aid, I mean, they've proffered this drink before, right? This is what happened. I mean, unwinding institutional integrity is a central part of the Trump project, right? I mean, whether it's the elections and the election workers or the jurors and the justice system, this is how the cookie crumbles, right? This is how you get people to believe that the whole thing is rigged. as an insurance policy against a loss for Donald Trump.
And you should expect that whoever and whatever they believe, whether they're in Alabama or New York City, they're going to uphold the law, listen to the law, and put their personal opinions aside. But it's incredibly difficult when you have someone like Donald Trump doing what he's doing outside that courtroom.
Ankush, I know you were making it or not making it to be the subject of a Jesse Waters tirade. But, you know, you were flagging, I think, very rightfully so and presciently, that these jurors are going to have a lot to contend with, that they may not feel comfortable being on the jury. They may not want to be public. We saw some departures this morning. Within the system as it exists now, what can be done to protect them short of the judge just requesting that the media broadly doesn't report out important personal details?
Well, I think that the judge took that step, but a second and more important step, which is that he ruled that the answers that the prospective jurors provide to the questions about their past and current occupations will not be made public, and they won't be present in the trial transcript for the public to review. I think that that's a very positive step. I don't think it will necessarily tamp all this down. In fact, I know that it won't. But it's a step in the right direction. I think the problem here is that it's kind of hard to change course midstream. This should have been resolved before this began. The judge issued an order on jury selection. The questions were public. Everybody knew what was going to happen. This was all eminently predictable. And so I also have to say I really take issue with some comments he made today directed at the press. This is not the press's fault. It's his fault and the DA's office's fault.
Can we talk a little bit about how to manage the situation? Because I know, you know, not only is changing midstream potentially problematic, the information about jurors is something that defendants traditionally get as the in the process of vetting them, right? Donald Trump is a very particular political animal. Is it problematic to not give the defense, you know, information like the jurors' employment or where they live? I mean, can you actually withhold that information from one side?
So this goes back to what we discussed, I just mentioned before. In the courtroom, Donald Trump is entitled to the same things that you and I would be entitled to have. And if he's going to accurately and fairly vet those potential jurors, he should know how long they've lived in Manhattan. He should know where they're from originally, not necessarily the street address, but what state are you from? What kind of work do you do? How long have you been in Manhattan? These are very reasonable and important questions that I have gotten for every juror, whether I was a prosecutor or a criminal defense attorney. It's the means by which he uses it later on,
right,
and other people to figure out who that person is who we're trying to protect so that integrity of the justice process can exist. You don't exploit it selfishly on the pulpit outside the courtroom.
Can you appeal? Like, could they use that as grounds for appeal? Like, we were basically, you know, picking this jury with one hand tied behind our back. We didn't realize we didn't have all the information.
Well, they're getting the information. They're getting the information. They're getting those questions and getting those answers.
Yeah.
That's not the issue. And what is being done is the defense and the prosecution will know the name, but they're getting a number. But other than that, they're getting the information that they need and they're being allowed to ask the questions.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no, that I have seen as of yet, some appellate issue that they're going to turn around. I'm sure they may try, but this is being done fairly. It's not what's happening in the courtroom. It's what's happening outside
the courtroom. Ankush, when we talk about jurors who are sort of, you know, we're still looking for alternates. I believe there are five more alternates need to be impaneled, if you will. Juror two effectively got cold feet the other day. I would assume there's a particular need for alternates in a trial like this, given the high stakes and the high wire act that it is participating in this trial. Like, is it possible, pardon the elementary nature of this question, but can jurors leave a trial if there are sort of external pressures that happen throughout the, you know, in the course of this trial and be replaced, you know, at any point? Is there a limit to the number of jurors who can say, I'm tapping out?
These are very good questions, and this could get tricky. I mean, so during the trial itself, yes, if something were to happen that the judge deemed appropriate to excuse someone, he could, in theory, do that and pull in one of the alternates. That's what the alternates are there for, right? Or if someone gets sick or whatever. But you're right. I mean, this isn't really the typical case or the typical fact pattern where we're just worried about people getting sick. And now he has six, which is an unusually a high number of alternates, but he's planning to get six. But I would not be surprised if the person who raised the concerns this morning is followed by more people. I mean, they weren't all there today. I mean, she was there because she had called the judge's chambers last night and the judge asked her to come in to explain. It's very possible that every other juror had similar experiences yesterday.
And I'm assuming there's not really a precedent for a mass departure or a significant number of jurors departing. Is there?
There's not. But I mean, look, in theory, if everyone he currently has seated were to, like, beg off, he now has in place a system that will at least limit the further public disclosure of some of the details that led to the unpleasantness for this person yesterday and maybe other people. So, like, the doomsday scenario you're kind of positing, which is you're right to be concerned about, I don't think it would end up with, like, the trial blowing up. It would just, they'd need to go further and just impanel more jurors.
Literally building the plane on the runway, as it were, it seems. Ankush Kardori, thank you so much, Ankush, for your time tonight. Really appreciate it. Jeremy, please stick around because I have more to ask you about the big piece of unfinished business in this Trump trial, namely whether anyone can make Donald Trump behave himself in court. And later, House Speaker Mike Johnson is trying really hard, not to run into the buzzsaw of his far right flank. Can he avoid them? Stick around for that.
Hey, everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Visit msnbc.com/app to download.
Day three of Donald Trump's criminal hush money trial ended with not only a seated jury, but also an interesting exchange. Just a few minutes ago, we got a transcript of today's proceedings, and here is how that interesting exchange went. Trump's lawyer, Todd Blanche, says, I would ask that the people, meaning the prosecution, provide us, the defense, with the names of their first three witnesses so that we can prepare. Prosecutor Joshua Steinglass. Look, I gotta be honest. That's a courtesy that we normally extend. Mr. Trump has been tweeting about the witnesses. We're not telling who the witnesses are. Judge Mershon. I can't fault the people for that. Mr. Blanche. What if I commit to the court and the people that President Trump will not tweet about any witness? Judge Mershon not buying it and saying to Trump's lawyer, I don't think you can make that representation. They won't give it to you today or tomorrow, and they're not required to. Boom. The concern over witness safety is part of a broader concern here about Donald Trump's outbursts. Earlier today in court, prosecutors asked Judge Mershon to hold Trump in contempt for 7 problematic social media posts he has made since the trial began on Monday. And that is on top of the other problematic posts Trump made earlier that the prosecution says violate his current gag order. Joining me now is Andrea Bernstein, journalist covering Trump and legal matters for National Public Radio, NPR, and author of American Oligarchs, The Kushners, The Trumps, and The Marriage of Money and Power. And of course, back with me is Jeremy Salant. It's great to have you both here. Andrea, I'm curious to hear your assessment of this. It really feels like we talked about the intersection between candidate Trump and defendant Trump. And here, candidate Trump's outbursts and, you know, sort of weaponization of the jurors and the trial and the witnesses is really redounding not to his benefit here, right? Like, the defense is not going to get the names of the first three witnesses because nobody trusts them to keep it under their hat.
Yes, that was a surprise. And, I mean, look, we all know who the witnesses are going to be here. It's not a huge surprise. It's just a question of order and strategy. But there was Judge Juan Mershon saying directly, I don't trust you to keep your mouth shut or your fingers off your keyboard. So therefore, you don't get this list. You've lost that privilege. And already, I mean, on the first day of the trial, when he said to Trump, writes that he reads to everybody, but it really resounded when he said, if you disrupt the proceedings, you can be expelled and I can send you to jail.
Right.
Because in all of the other trials that I have covered, of Trump that he has attended, he has disrupted the proceedings. He's had interactions with the judge. He's muttered in front of the jury. I mean, he's spoken, I should say, audibly in front of the jury. I could hear him. They could hear him. And he stood up and gave his own closing arguments in the fraud trial after he had been told directly by the judge, you can't do that.
Right.
So when Rahsaan says that, he has the weight of history behind him in that judgment.
I mean, I also think that it betrays the, well, like, should we call it a fractured relationship between Trump and his lawyers? Like, his lawyers are out there saying, well, what if we promise you our client isn't going to tweet about this? And or we're just going to keep it amongst ourselves. And the judge is effectively saying, like, you have no basis for saying that. You have no control over your client.
They can't make that promise. And just to be very clear, the court is not, or pardon me, Josh Steinglass is not saying, I'm not going to give you the witness's name and information. That's already been turned over.
Mm-hmm.
To your point, it's just the order of who's being called. And in a normal course of things with a very cordial relationship, that's shared. But to your point again, he is undeserving, meaning Donald Trump, to act as he is acting to get that information.
I mean, and I would assume, just in by way of preparation, it's good to have the information, even if you know who they're going to be. The order of things is not insignificant.
But you also expect that you're prepared for all those witnesses, whoever they come.
Sure.
But you it would be very helpful, unequivocally so.
And also, this happening day one, it doesn't exactly set the stage for, I don't know, a cordial working relationship between the two. I mean, it is an adversarial process, Andrea. But you point out the way in which Trump is incapable of censoring himself or exhibiting self-control. And I wonder if you think the duration of this trial, the fact that he has to be there every day, you can tell us what it's like inside that courtroom, but it doesn't sound like a trip to Disneyland.
Yeah, I mean, he's obviously unhappy. I mean, I think that one of the things that happened in the course of the other trials was that he figured out a way to make it redound to his benefit. This trial, he is going to be listening to testimony about an extramarital affair that he had in 2006 and a hush money payment, stuff that is much clearer to the public than he overvalued or he undervalued his assets or how much is Mar-a-Lago worth anyway. Everybody knows what having an affair means, and everybody knows what a porn star is, and everybody knows what a Playboy model is. Mm-hmm. And he has to sit there and listen to that day in, day out. I mean, when I was reporting previously and speaking to people who worked for him, they said he could barely sit in any single room for any period of time, that they were told when they gave him presentations to give him one word and three images.
Right.
And this is, I mean, long days in a very kind of cruddy and uncomfortable courtroom, which is either too hot or too cold, and just, you know, a very far cry from Trump Tower.
Well, and he made a point outside of the court today to talk about what a sham trial it was. He was armed with a stack of newspaper printouts printouts of website and internet articles, and complained about the temperature in the courtroom. This is someone whose self-control is going to have to extend not just to the courtroom itself, but after hours as well, right? I mean, the question
here
is,
what's at issue?
And the gag order, I mean, I guess my question to you would be, what is your expectation about this gag order?
I mean, he has really been challenged in following any of these gag orders. But, you know, I mean, I think Rahsaan has clearly shown that he is drawing a line, Judge Rahsaan, and that he is not going to accept it. So we shall see. I mean, as with everything else in this trial, we have no priors.
Right.
So we cannot say what is going to happen because we don't know one minute to the next, let alone one day to the next. All we know is that Trump has a really hard time. I mean, for example, after he was told to pay $83 million to E. Jean Carroll, there was a period where he stopped saying, I didn't do it. And then he started again. And $83 million is quite a disincentive.
Yes.
So can he keep his mouth shut now? We shall see. What will it take? We will find out.
Do you think a couple hours at Rikers is even in the cards? I mean, I hesitate to even say that because it seems so far-fetched.
Well, first of all, number one, contempt can be civil or criminal. And if it happens in front of the judge can summarily say you've committed contempt. If it happens outside, like the tweeting or truth socialing, if that's a verb.
True thing.
Then it's a separate actual hearing. He has a right to, you know, challenge that. Will the judge put him in for up to 30 days on Rikers Island? Probably not. Could he sit, you know, cool his heels, you know, in the tombs behind? Maybe that's possible. $1,000 fine is really insignificant, but it's that exposure for most people who don't go to this point. But for most people, know that I can go to jail for 30 days, and a judge can make that decision, and it's pretty serious. So, is it possible that he sits somewhere on the side there.
In an even colder room?
Yeah, or even right there. There's benches he could sit. It's certainly possible, but he's not going to go to Rikers. And he knows that. He knows that. So
stress testing the judicial system. That is where we are right now. Andrea Bernstein, Jeremy Saland, it's great to see you both. Thanks for your time and thoughts tonight.
Great to talk to you.
Coming up, they call themselves the fart team. Really, they actually do. And they have Speaker Mike Johnson in a very uncomfortable place. That is coming up next.
Alpha One Niner, commence Wi-Fi device checklist.
Laptops on. TVs streaming. Game console consoling. Smart thermostat set for cuddle time. Doorbell camera. Oh, my package is here.
Fast, reliable, able to power tons of devices inside your home at once.
All systems go, you are clear for takeoff.
This is Xfinity Internet, Wi-Fi built to wow. And watch the short film, The Aviators, now playing at Xfinity.com. Restrictions apply. Actual speeds vary and are not guaranteed.
Hey, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening? MSNBC legal correspondent Lisa Rubin joins to unpack the Trump trial.
One of the big takeaways from this is, is our system flawed, not in the sense that more people can't access that process, but in just giving that much process in the sense that someone like Donald Trump can abuse it? Most criminal defendants never get the chance to exercise all of their due process rights. Donald Trump is stretching due process beyond its point of elasticity.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow.
Whenever Donald Trump decides he doesn't want to commit to something, whenever he wants to punt on a question about something within his control, he always says the same thing.
We'll see what happens. We'll see what happens.
We'll see what happens. We'll see what happens. So we'll see what happens. But we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens. See what happens. We'll see what happens. So we'll see what happens. We're going to see what happens. But we'll see. But we'll see. The end result is we'll see.
We'll see what happens. This week, Donald Trump added the fate of House Speaker Mike Johnson to the list of things where he'll just wait and see what happens.
Johnson, Mr. President, are you going to protect Speaker Johnson?
Well, we'll see what happens with that. I think he's very good.
Did he brief you on his plan to do four separate foreign aid bills?
Mike Johnson is in trouble. Right now, the Speaker of the House appears to be moving forward with a plan to allow a standalone vote on aid to Ukraine, which has made House conservatives absolutely furious. Some of them are ready to kick Mike Johnson out of the job the same way they ousted Speaker Kevin McCarthy just 6 months ago. And Mike Johnson is running out of options to save himself. At the beginning of the day, as in today, there were rumblings that Johnson might try to change House rules in order to make it harder for conservatives to oust him. That proposal, unsurprisingly, outraged conservatives who confronted the Speaker on the House floor. CNN reports that Johnson was essentially pinned against the back wall of the House floor with members on all sides of him, with the Speaker constantly pivoting his head as he responded to members speaking to him. Sounds hectic. If that congressional bullying circle wasn't sufficient to get Johnson in line, conservative members also put together a team to monitor the House floor to make sure that neither Johnson or his allies introduced a measure to change the rules on them. And they called themselves the Floor Action Response Team. F-A-R-T. FART. Yes, that is really what they call themselves. FART. But you had to take them seriously, even though they call themselves FART. Because all day long, these conservatives were telling any reporter who would listen that they were not happy with Speaker Johnson and that they would not abide any changes to these rules.
Our goal is to avoid a motion to vacate, but we are not going to surrender that accountability tool, particularly in a time when we're seeing America's interests subjugated to foreign interests abroad.
He's serving Ukraine first and America last.
You have our own border that's open, and yet the funding would actually be going to securing Ukraine border beforehand, which is simply not acceptable.
By the end of the day, Mike Johnson caved to the FART caucus. In a statement on X, he announced that he would not change the rules for ousting a speaker, a.k.a. himself, saying we will continue to govern under the existing rules. So Speaker Mike Johnson has zero protection right now. He cannot change the rules to stop conservative members from kicking him out of office. And the only person who can protect him here, Donald Trump, appears to be completely indifferent to Johnson's fate. That is what it means to be a Republican these days. Give Donald Trump your undying loyalty, knowing that Trump may throw you under the bus whenever it suits him. Gotta just wait and see what happens. And now we're seeing what it looks like when Republicans whose backs are already covered in tire marks come crawling back to Trump. I'm going to talk about that with Atlantic staff writer McKay Coppins next.
You support him for president, even if he's convicted in classified documents. You support him for president, even though you believe he contributed to an insurrection. You support him for president, even though you believe he's lying about the last election. You support him for president, even if he's convicted in the Manhattan case. I just want to say the answer to that is yes, correct?
Yeah, me and 51% of America.
You said it would be an honor to be offered a spot on his ticket. Really?
Yeah, I think anyone who's offered the opportunity to serve this country as vice president should be honored. I think the country and the world was a better place when he was president. And I would love to see him return to the White House.
That was New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu and Florida Senator Marco Rubio crowing about Donald Trump after spending quite a while criticizing him. Just a year ago, Governor Sununu wrote an op-ed in The Washington Post slamming Trump for peddling the conspiracy theory that he won the 2020 election and repelling independents. Senator Rubio, meanwhile, called Trump a con man and a fake tough guy. Rubio and Sununu are not alone, and they aren't even among the most egregious in their sudden change of heart. For that, you'd have to look towards former Attorney General Bill Barr. The same Bill Barr who said that Trump's actions on January 6th amounted to a grave wrongdoing. The same Bill Barr who called Trump a consummate narcissist. The same Bill Barr who predicted abuse of power if Trump were to be elected again. That Bill Barr has now endorsed Donald Trump.
I will vote the Republican ticket.
You will.
I will support the Republican ticket. I think the real danger to the country, the real danger to democracy, as I say, is the progressive agenda. And while Trump, and I said, Trump may be playing Russian roulette, but continuation of the Biden administration is national suicide, in my opinion.
Joining me now is McKay Coppins, staff writer at The Atlantic. McKay, I do wonder, what is your reaction to this Bill Barr endorsement of Donald Trump after all that we've heard from the man in the course of the last several years?
It's interesting, right? Because, you know, some of the other clips you showed, Chris Sununu, Marco Rubio, these are Republican politicians who still want to have a future in Republican politics. And so you can kind of understand the craven calculation that they're making, which is, you know, Donald Trump is the leader of our party. He's the most popular Republican in our party. I have to be aligned with him, regardless of what I think, if I want to keep having a job. Bill Barr is a curious case because, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't know what future he has at this point in the party, right? He's not going to run for office. It's unlikely that he would certainly return to a Trump administration. Trump hates him. So what is he doing here? And, you know, I've spent a lot of time writing about, reporting on, thinking about the psychology of these Republicans who understand who Trump is and the threat that he poses and still find themselves supporting him. And I think it's important to understand that it's not always just a simple case of cowardice. I mean, cowardice is kind of woven into the calculation, but it's also, you know, it's something more complicated. I remember talking to Mitt Romney about this, the Utah senator, and he said, you know, when you're as entrenched in a political party as somebody like Bill Barr is, as somebody like Mitt Romney is, you've spent decades making friends, allies, raising money for, getting money from Republican institutions. It's really hard to disentangle yourself from that party apparatus. And turning on Trump in the year 2024, as it was true in 2020 and 2016, it kicks you out of that, your whole social ecosystem. And I think that that's probably part of what's going on with all these Republicans that you just showed. I think that they just don't want to be people without a party. And so they kowtow to Trump, even though they know how dangerous he is.
That's such a brilliant explanation for it, McKay, a very deeply thoughtful one. But I was also struck by the fact that Bill Barr calls a vote for Biden a vote for national suicide. And I wonder from your conversations with Republicans, what lies at the root of that indignation? This idea that the progressive agenda is so suicidal that it trumps pardon the metaphor, what Bill Barr has outlined are a series of grave concerns about Donald Trump's leadership. I mean, do you have a sense of what, how Bill Barr justifies this in terms of the others, in terms of the Biden candidacy?
So I don't know what Bill Barr's specific issue is. I think it varies depending on the Republican you talk to, right? So if you are a dyed-in-the-wool social conservative, for example, you might believe that the trade-off in the judiciary, the Supreme Court, Roe v. Wade, things like that, are worth kind of making a deal with a kind of, you know, madman, the way that they see Donald Trump as. If you're somebody who is a single-issue voter, you're thinking about deregulation. Maybe that's your issue. I don't know what Bill Barr's issue is, but I do think that he represents a real phenomenon, which is that I think the way that a lot of these Republicans get to the point where they can get back on board with Trump after saying that he's a threat to democracy, he's a threat to the constitutional order, is by kind of narrowing their view of this race in a way that they think of it as a traditional partisan, you know, party politics election, right? It's a Democrat and a Republican, and I disagree with the Democrats, and, you know, everything else aside, the Democratic agenda is bad. And I've spent my entire life, my entire career built around that idea that the Democratic agenda is evil, it's bad, and it's bad for the country. And I think that they kind of rationalize their way into supporting Donald Trump because they go back to thinking about this election as a kind of traditional election.
Yeah.
The elections you had in the 90s or the 80s, right?
But it's not that at all, right? I mean, they may rationalize it. The Republican Party, as it is, let's look at Congress, where Mike Johnson is facing ouster for bringing forth a Ukraine funding bill, which in the 90s would have been a no-brainer for the Republican Party. I mean, Trump has just made the party about him, and fealty and loyalty to Trump get you nothing. Mike Johnson was down in Mar-a-Lago kissing the ring last week. And this today, Donald Trump really doesn't have an opinion on whether Mike Johnson deserves to keep his job. Is that not a cautionary tale for any of these Republicans?
It's such a good point, and it's the thing that I constantly am bringing up when I talk to Republican leaders, because effectively the deal that Donald Trump has offered Republican politicians is, you swear to me your absolute, unvarnished, abject loyalty, often in humiliating ways, and in return, I offer you nothing. Right?
Yes.
Trump offers no loyalty. There's no, time and time again, he has betrayed, humiliated, ousted, gotten rid of, ended the careers of Republicans who have humiliated themselves sucking up to him. And you would think, we're almost a decade into this phenomenon, you would think by now Republicans would understand that they have no protection, right? But that at the same time, I think that the calculation a lot of them are making is that Donald Trump might not guarantee me anything, but the voters that elect me love Donald Trump. And at the very least, if I'm on board with him, they won't revolt against me right away. And I really think that's the calculation most of them are making. Again, I don't see how that applies to Bill Barr, who is not running for anything. And I would like to see more reporting on what led him to this decision.
Yeah, me too. He's not running for anything. The policy doesn't exist and the loyalty is non-existent. Okay, Bill. McKay Coppins, thank you for your time, my friend. It's great to see you as always.
Thanks, Alex.
Coming up, Russian state media is saying that Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene believes that Americans should help Vladimir Putin. That is a thing that is actually happening. We are going to explain coming up next. Today, police in Germany arrested two men accused of being Russian secret agents who had planned to bomb industrial and military sites across Germany, including a U.S. military base in Bavaria. The goal of these two Russian operatives in Germany was to undermine Western support for Ukraine. This is now one of Vladimir Putin's primary goals, to weaken the United States and other Western democracies and drive a wedge between them and Ukraine. Here in the U.S., some Republican members of Congress, like Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, seem to be in lockstep with that plan. This week, Congresswoman Greene introduced multiple amendments to the Ukraine aid package, including one that prohibits funding for Ukraine until Ukraine stops persecuting Christians, something that Ukraine does not do. Another prohibits funds until Ukraine bans abortion. Then there is her proposed requirement for members of Congress to join the Ukrainian army if they vote for this supplemental aid. Lastly, Green threw in an amendment for the U.S. to withdraw from NATO. Is it any wonder that this is how Russian state media talks about Marjorie Taylor Greene?
Из альянса призывает конгрессвумен Марджори Тейлор Грин.
Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene is proposing for the U.S. to withdraw from NATO. She believes that Americans should help Putin win.
Joining me now is Anne Applebaum, a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, author, and staff writer with The Atlantic. Anne, thanks for being here. I wonder if you could sort of give me your reaction to Russian state media now covering the MAGA caucus of the House Republican Conference.
I think it's important to understand why this is happening and how it's connected to the reason why Russia invaded Ukraine in the first place. Part of the point of invading Ukraine was to show that Russia doesn't care about rules. It doesn't care about European rules about not changing borders by force. It wants to defy U.S. power. It wants to show that the U.S. isn't important anymore in Europe. By enabling, people who are critical of the United States and enemies of the United States, they can make this plan come true. And they have used a really extraordinary level of propaganda, of a kind of information campaign that's designed to show that the United States isn't powerful anymore, it isn't important anymore, and the way in which they can really make sure that this works is by getting Americans to say it too. So Marjorie Taylor Greene is playing right into their plan.
I just wonder, I mean, what Marjorie Taylor Greene is one thing, but the Heritage Foundation, or at least Heritage Action, which is their campaign arm, is also on board with a plan that is so explicitly against America's interests. This is a tweet from Heritage Action. The political arm of the conservative think tank is notifying Hill offices of its opposition to the rule governing foreign aid bills, warning of a key vote no to lawmakers. They do not want to pass a supplemental aid package to Ukraine. I mean, does it surprise you that a very explicitly pro-Russian plan has found such comfort, if you will, at the Heritage Foundation?
It doesn't, because, as I said, this has been part of a Russian idea for many months. Their idea is to create a kind of links between themselves and the far right of the Conservative Party in the UK, and the far right of the Republican Party in the United States, the far right of other political parties in Europe. I mean, they do so through this kind of false, anti-wokeness language, through the language of traditional conservatism and religion, much of which isn't true. I mean, Russia is, it's interesting that Marjorie Taylor Greene was talking about Ukraine having abortion. Russia, of course, also has legal abortion. Very few people in Russia go to church. Russia is actually the country that persecutes Christians, particularly evangelical Christians. And yet they've successfully portrayed themselves as some kind of ally of the far right. And they've done it all over the world. They've done it in the U.S. They've done it in Europe. And unfortunately, people have bought it, whether they've bought it for ideological reasons, whether they've bought it for financial reasons, we're not sure, whether they just find it useful to have somebody else supporting that kind of rhetoric. We don't know the full answers yet. But yes, it's true that there is a part of the Republican Party that now effectively serves as the voice of Russia and its allies. Remember that Russia is allied to Iran. Russia is allied to China. Russia is allied to autocracies all over the rest of the world, and many of them use the same kind of language.
Can you, to that end, I mean, can you kind of paint a picture of the implications if Ukraine loses this war? Not just implications for Ukraine, but in terms of the sort of global order of things.
If Ukraine loses this war, it will be understood throughout the world as a loss for the United States, as a loss of American influence, as the end of a certain set of American ideas about diplomacy, about borders being sacrosanct, about the right of smaller nations to exist and not be tormented by larger nations. It will really be understood as the end of American power and influence.
Vice President Mike Pence said that he believes that Putin will wage war on NATO if Ukraine loses the war. Do you think that that's hyperbole?
It's what the Russians say. It's what Putin says. It's what Russian propagandists say. They repeat themselves. They periodically threaten Poland. They threaten the Baltic states. Sometimes, for fun, they threaten the United Kingdom or the United States. They say it all the time. And so, if they're saying it all the time, maybe we should take them seriously.
Believe what people tell you. Anne Applebaum with The Atlantic. Thank you so much for your wisdom on this, Anne. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That is our show for tonight.